Peace School Color listeners, this is Mark Winston Griffith coming to you again from my backyard.
And this is Max Friedman, kind of, sort of, social distancing from Mark in Mark's backyard.
BMC and our citizen journalism arm, Brooklyn Deep, have been working on a project to make sure folks in central Brooklyn have the power to take full advantage of the June 23rd primary elections in New York and hold elected officials accountable around social change demands. It includes a dedicated webpage with candidate research, voter information, candidate debates, and interviews on our Third Rail podcast platform with smart activists who can help us better understand the political moment we're in today. Go to brooklynmovementcenter.org/elections2020.
On this installment, we are bringing you interviews with the candidates for the 57th Assembly District in Central Brooklyn, conducted by BMC's own Antonine Pierre. We hope you'll find what you need to make an informed decision in the voting booth or with your absentee ballot.
And of course, continue to check out your school colors feed to see what we're cooking up. In the meantime, keep listening, stay safe, and please don't forget to vote on June 23rd. Peace.
Peace, everyone. Welcome to Brooklyn Deep's Third Rail, where we tackle political and social change issues that impact the lives of Central Brooklynites. I'm Antonine Pierre, Deputy Director of Brooklyn Movement Center, and your guest host today. I know y'all are usually used to hearing Mark, but you know, it's quarantine, it's social distancing, everything's a little upside down. So on today's show, we're digging into these politics to bring you interviews with the two candidates who are running to be Democratic candidates for the 57th Assembly District, Walter Mosley and Farrah Souffran. So I'm here first with Walter Mosley. Could you introduce yourself? Say hi to the people.
Hey, BMC and Antony, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for still moving forward with your programming, even in the midst of this state of emergency during this pandemic, which has shut the state down. But that doesn't mean that we don't keep on moving forward in terms of our agendas. My name is New York State Assemblyman Walter Mosley. I represent the 57th Assembly District, which represents the neighborhoods of Clinton Hill, Fort Greene, Prospect Heights, and portions of Bedford-Stuyvesant and portions of Crown Heights. I've been serving this community pretty much all my life. Grew up in Crown Heights. My mom and my dad were raised in Crown Heights. Then we moved to Clinton Hill, where my mother still lives, and where I live and have the opportunity to represent. I have been serving, like I said, since 2013. I sit on several committees, but some of the more important committees I serve on are housing, education, corrections, codes, which we call that the criminal justice, de facto criminal justice committee. And I also chair the career development subcommittee, which is under the umbrella of the labor committee. It's been my honor to not only serve this community, but a community that helped raise me. In a community in which I raise my children in. So it's a pleasure and a privilege to be here, and I look forward to our conversation.
Great. Thanks so much. You gave so much good intro. So for voters who have never heard of you, you've told us a little bit about who you are, but why should they vote for you?
Well, I think the one thing I think we want to try to do is when we present ourselves is that we present ourselves with a track record, that's proven to come from what we originally ran on. So for me, that was the creation of the preservation of affordable housing. And over these years, we've not only been able to pass the most progressive package of tenant protection laws in the TPU of 2019 was a package of laws which strengthened tenants' rights and allowed for us to preserve the affordable housing that we do have in our stock. But then also some of the affordable housing that we were still able to preserve. So whether it was preserving Mitchell Lama housing in the Clinton Hill section of my district, or preserving rent stabilized housing in the old Crown Heights Jewish Hospital facility, which has over thousands of residents who rely upon rent stabilized units, or working diligently on behalf of my NYCHA residents, making sure that they got the necessary resources, even in the midst of the city's shortcomings. But we also talked about criminal justice reform. Making sure that we did our part to kind of discontinue that pipeline to our criminal justice facilities upstate New York, making sure that we advocate for young Black and brown men and women, even in the midst of stop and frisk, understanding that we dealt with stop and frisk through my predecessor. Now, it was about my time to talk about bail reform, talking about parole reform, talking about elder law and solitary confinement reform. So those things coupled with, as a former educator, a third generation educator, understanding the importance of education, that if we don't make an investment into our young people, we are forfeiting our future. So obviously advocating for a campaign for fiscal equity. And although we have not made good on that promise to adhere to properly funding our children and particularly our public school students, that has unfortunately allowed for me to vote no on these last two budgets in large part because of that. So whether we're talking about education, whether we're talking about housing, whether we're talking about criminal justice reform, three of the major things that was a part of my platform that I continue to advocate for and that we've been able to have some significant accomplishments going forward, but ultimately making sure that we move Brooklyn forward while leaving no one behind.
Great, thank you. Yeah, you hit a lot of good notes and we're gonna dig into some of those issues a little bit later. But first, you know, all of our lives have been upended by COVID-19. And if you're a Black person in Central Brooklyn, you've definitely been talking about what it's looked like for the disproportionate impacts or for Central Brooklynites to be disproportionately impacted from the racial disparities in social distancing arrests to the infection rates and how different they are in the district versus outside of the district. So right. What's your assessment of what is needed with in Central Brooklyn as a response to COVID-19?
Well, I think what needs to be done, and I started talking about this when the preliminary budget negotiations were happening right before the April 1st statutory constitutional deadline for us to pass the on-time budget. And then I was talking about the drastic and the draconian cuts to our healthcare system that was absolutely over the top, something that we felt as a member of the Assembly Majority and a lot of my colleagues felt was too much in terms of taking away from the infrastructure that so many people rely upon, particularly those who are Medicaid and Medicare assisted patients. But what happened with the onslaught of COVID, it only just highlighted that point. It only brought that to the forefront. And I think what we really need to do is kind of just reevaluate that although we have the One Brooklyn Health Initiative and although we tried to get away from brick and mortar, that when times get rough and a pandemic happens, the one place we turn to is to our hospitals and to the people who are in those hospitals. And I'm thankful that I have the endorsement of 1199 and NYSNA, because we've been partners in advocating for a One Brooklyn Health System while as we consolidate hospitals in terms of their ability to be efficient and sustainable in providing services, that they do it in a coordinated fashion. So no one's disconnected. There's no institutions operating in separate silos, but they're all connected. But at the same time, understanding that we can't do this without the proper personnel, the properly trained personnel who are in those hospitals to meet out a situation just like this. So I think going forward, we need to kind of think about how do we move forward with how do we provide healthcare, but at the same time, understanding that we have to kind of reevaluate and study this impact, this disproportionate impact that this pandemic has had on our community, particularly Black and Brown communities throughout the city of New York and throughout cities throughout the state, because we're all experiencing the same thing, whether you're talking about Albany or Rochester or Buffalo. We are Nassau County. We are all experiencing a disproportionate impact of people who are not only being affected, but who are dying. And unfortunately, Brooklyn has become, as you know, the epic center of the most deaths related to COVID in the state of New York and in the country. So we are looking at this as an opportunity, but we also have to be frank and honest with ourselves in terms of what we need to do so going forward when we do hit another pandemic, that we don't find ourselves with the same results.
Great, thanks. And for folks who may not know NYSNA, that's the New York State Nurses Association. And I think what is helpful is you have definitely been vocal on these issues. And I guess a question as a Central Brooklynite is, how do you see your role in the assembly in terms of securing those things that we need? So going beyond the bully pulpit.
So in the past, you know, we've always been frank about with the governor and the executive branch that hospitals like Interfaith Hospital, which is a safety net hospital, hospitals like Woodhull, another safety net hospital, have to be a part of the equation, have to be a part of the solution going forward. We cannot think that, and I think we've seen this bear fruit, unfortunately, when we saw the closing of Litch, Long Island College Hospital in downtown Brooklyn, and the impact that it had on the community as a whole. When people, you know, took for granted a hospital of that nature and that caliber being eliminated, the vacuum that it left was immense. So hospitals like Methodist and other hospitals had to take the brunt of all those other patients. And as a result, it impacted their quality of healthcare that they could give to their clients or customers, or, you know. So to me, I think as much as I advocate for Brooklyn Hospital, which is a privately run hospital, but yet we do get a disproportionate number of Medicaid and Medicare patients. We also have to fight for hospitals like Interfaith and Woodhull, because ultimately they're all a part of the same network. They all serve the similar communities, similar demographics. Some people have private insurance, some people don't, but we also ultimately have to talk about how do we get to a system of universal healthcare and a one healthcare system where we're serving everybody. Because what we're seeing now in this pandemic is that healthcare related to people's jobs could have a far, far more detrimental impact than if we were to have a pre-existing universal healthcare bill, a bill that I'm a co-prime sponsor on, that's been advocated for many years by Assemblyman Dick Gottfried and Senator Gustavo Rivera from the Bronx, that if we don't see the problem behind having our healthcare affiliated with our job status or employment status, then we're going to be winding up in the same predicament as we have in the past. So we have to find the resources. We have to do what we can to raise resources, whether it's raising revenue through taxation, whether it's through our millionaires tax or ultra millionaires tax or billionaires tax or Peter Ter or stocks transfer tax. We have to find ways to raise revenue so that we can provide for services that are universally accepted around the world, and that we see in other countries who have universal health care that they're not in the same predicament. There's a correlation between why we have over 100,000 people dying of this disease. We make up almost a third of those who have lost their lives globally. And yet we have to find out, we still have to justify why we still need universal health care going forward.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for also parsing out, you know, some of the different issues with healthcare, right? I mean, how we get health insurance and then separately, just naming for folks that, and talking about the hospitals, the part of the reason why so much of this conversation in the state revolves around funding is that hospitals are administrated by the Health and Hospitals Corporation, which is a city entity, but that the state's role in that really is to draw down funding, right? So I would love to talk about health all day, especially because that's the time that we end, but I think I only have time really for one more follow-up question here, which is, you speak about taxation and that being a way to draw down the revenue into public hospitals that we need. And we know that public hospitals are largely used by poor people, right? People who can't afford to go to Brooklyn Hospital. So you're talking about taxation in terms of like pied-à-terres, and for folks who don't know, those are like if you have a co-op that you rent but you don't live in, for example. So how do you, in terms of taxation and rectifying this issue, do you feel like, are you advocating for progressive tax policies, or and for folks listening, progressive tax policies, ideally taxing the rich to provide services for folks who can't afford them?
Without question. You know, there are different ways in which we can raise revenue. So we can raise revenue, for instance, through online gaming, right? We can raise revenue if we pass the Cannabis Regulation Taxation Act, the CRTA. Where I sit on the co-chair of the task force for the caucus, along with our prime sponsor, Crystal People Stokes from Buffalo, our majority leader. And then on top of that, we can also raise taxes the more traditional way, through taxing those individuals who have disproportionately been able to skirt our laws and skirt paying their proportionate amount of tax to state coffers. because of special interests and people who are allowed to be protected. But to me, if we can't raise taxes on the ultra rich during a time like this, this will be used against us going forward for any other times in which we start talking about raising, trying to generate revenue through taxation. Because during a global pandemic, where we will probably experience a recession for the next year or two, where millions of New Yorkers have lost their jobs and still losing their jobs, and we are still trying to determine how we're going to open up as a state, that if we can't justify raising revenue now through taxes, when will we ever have this opportunity to do so? So I think we're setting ourselves up for a big downfall, for a huge disappointment if we don't do this. I know that myself, along with some of my more progressive colleagues, have been talking about this for years, and in large part why we voted no on the budget, in part because if everybody is expected to benefit from the ultimate comeback of the state of New York, that means everybody should be chipping in proportionate to what they can chip in. It's still a conversation that's on the rolls. We know that so many public entities and public jobs will be lost. Taxable revenue that through payroll taxes that will be lost. So we have to find ways to come up with money to pay for programs that will put us in a far better position than when we were before the COVID-19 pandemic. Because if we don't, the next pandemic we hit could have a far more devastating impact. And we know how devastating this current pandemic has had, not only on our healthcare system and the health of New Yorkers, you know, throughout our state, but also on the economy of our state.
Yeah, listen, we can't even talk about the next pandemic yet because we're not through with this one. So let's take it slow because folks are going through it, right? You've mentioned the budget a bunch. So I want to talk a little bit about that. You know, full disclosure for folks listening, Brooklyn Movement Center did work around rolling back bail reform. And actually, the Assembly member and I have been at a lot of the same press conferences, right? So that said, you voted no on the budget. And
the last 2 years.
Great. So tell us what that means, right? Because as an Assembly member, the Assembly in total actually voted to approve that budget. So how do you connect your leadership as a Black Assembly member in Central Brooklyn to this no vote? And what does that mean for Central Brooklynites when budget was ultimately passed?
Right. And look, you know, when you make a no vote, you're making more so just a statement, right? And you hope that your statement resonates with your colleagues. So the first time I voted no, prior to that, you know, there were other members who had been voting no, and usually it would be like maybe two or three members, right? 2 years ago, when I voted no on all 9 budget resolutions, in large part because of a number of issues, but the main two issues was the campaign fiscal equity, which we did not come to bear fruit. And then obviously my stance to support the WFP and the Working Family Party and the trying to codify the ending of fusion voting to public financing. And although I wholeheartedly support public financing, to couple that with the ending of fusion voting and third party ballot lines, to me, I thought was unconstitutional affair. And subsequently we won our lawsuit is being appealed. But I was proud to be a part of that. So sometimes you make a statement, not for the sense that you know you're going to be, you know, victorious, but you make a statement to hope to bring others along. So 2 years ago, I think it was like 11 or 12 of us that voted no on the budget. This year was close to 30. And remember, you need we try to have at least a majority of votes from the Assembly majority to pass the budget. We don't rely upon Republican votes. So as you get closer to that number, you tend to realize that your voice and your vote has more weight with each passing cycle because you hope to bring on more colleagues of like minds to then be in a position to kind of help shape what is ultimately going to be put in the budget resolutions and then subsequently voted upon. So to me, I think that you do this to kind of like just plant a seed, and you hope that when that seed blossoms, that you're in the position to take advantage of displaying that flower, and then ultimately benefiting from how it bears fruit. So to me, I think this year was a good year in the sense that we had like close to 30 members who voted no, and vast majority of them voted no on a number of reasons, but I voted no on this year in large part because of the rollback of the bail reform, in part, and a bill that we just passed less than a year that went into effect less than several months, and we passed last year, and special interests from law enforcement was able to weigh in and put us in a position where we rolled back on some of the things that we knew was, if we were to vote on, we were going to be sentencing people to their death sentence, because we knew at that point what was happening with COVID, and we knew that if we rolled back, that there were going to be some people who were going to go back into these jails, not come out, and ultimately die. And for me, people like Michael Tyson, he got a parole violation, but he was sent to into Rikers, healthy, 53-year-old man, contacted COVID, and died in jail, not to ever been adjudicated, not to have ever been able to stand before his peers. So you make these votes on a myriad of reasons, but what you ultimately do, you set up a track record of principled positions that people then will take notice. So when you do go back to your district, you can look them in the face and explain why you did what you did was better for their betterment and for the betterment of their children.
Great. Thank you. Thanks especially for just making clear some of the wild politics of Albany. And also, you really connected the budget to the stakes, right? Like that the stakes here, when we talk about the budget, it's often covered in the media as a political fight, but you're talking about life and death, right? Like you're literally talking about freedom, people being free. You're talking about people dying.
To me, I think sometimes we get to a point where we have so many people with titles that we forget the reasons why we're in the positions we're in now. And it's great to have, a person of color being the leader of the Senate majority. It's great to have a person of color leading the assembly. It's great to have a person who's of color, who's our attorney general. But that has to translate into something that is beneficial to not only people of color now, but people of color going forward. How do we create institutions within institutions so that people who will never meet, people who we'll never know, people who will be around before, after we're long gone, will benefit from our service here in the state legislature. And I think that, we have to come to grips to that as men and women of color. It's just not about what you can attain personally or professionally, but what can you attain for people that you'll never know, people you'll never meet, and people who will be around long after you are gone from this earth. And to me, I think that has always been the mantra I've had and continue to have, prior to coming into this as a district leader and state committeeman, and now as a sitting member of the New York State Assembly, because then that's how you keep your moral compass. That's how you keep grounded. That's how you keep rooted into the original reason as to why you decided what you decided to do when you said, I'm going to run for public office. But we're not too far from that, but we don't want to get too far from it. And I think that we have to have some serious conversations, as people of color in the state legislature as to why are we here? Let's ask that simple question and then we can move from there.
I just want to name, of course we got to get a little messy. We got to get into like who disagrees with you, yes, and what they disagree about, right?
Right.
A lot of affordable housing activists have not really been in support of this Franklin Avenue high rise that you have been on the record in support of, right?
Right.
So, if you could just give us just like your take, your background on this particular development and like why you're supporting it.
Mm-hmm. That project is still being formalized in terms of height, in terms of density, because we have another project that's really up the street, the Carmel Realty Project, which is across the street from Botanical Gardens as well, where we are fighting in court in terms of determining its density, its size, its height, its impact on the part on Botanical Gardens. And we know that once this goes through all the channels, that it will have and I've said this to many of the advocates in that area, it will have a tremendous impact on what will happen on the Franklin Avenue project. The Franklin Avenue project, I agree upon in large part, because often we have men and women who are working on these sites, who are working to build Brooklyn and New York, but can't afford to live in the same buildings in which they're helping to build. And what this project will allow for is for real affordability on a 50-50 basis for working class men and women, because the trade unions will be taking from their pension funds and will be making a significant investment, which ultimately brings down the cost of building this project, which ultimately brings up the level of affordability. Now, there is no, whether you're talking about MIH, whether you're talking about any other program that's out there, there is no program that
And what's MIH for folks who are
mandatory inclusionary housing? That's the city's program, which I believe she needs to be revamped, if not scrapped altogether, because I don't think it brings about
the council about that.
Yeah, I don't think it brings about the level of affordability that people thought it would bring. In fact, I think it's almost the reverse. But this building will bring about a 50-50 breakdown in terms of real affordability based upon real AMI. AMI in that area of my district for a family of four is like $41,000, $42,000. And to me, that's what I agree upon. Now, I have not agreed upon the actual height. We have not agreed upon the density. We still are looking at the shadow studies and so forth and so on. But that's what I agree upon. And that was a part of my platform from the very beginning before I became the Assemblyman, about creating affordable housing and preserving affordable housing, because we just can't preserve affordable housing and lock ourselves out to everything else that's going on around us, because then we wouldn't have been able to renegotiate the terms of the Bedford Union Armory. We wouldn't have been able to negotiate and still are renegotiating the terms of the Pacific Park project on the northern side of my district, which is the largest investment that the state has made towards a public-private partnership of this nature when we're talking about building housing and affordable housing. So I hope that people take into context that, you know, these are all things that we're dealing with: creating affordable housing, preserving affordable housing, and advocating for public policy that will be the undergird for both entities. So that's my position, and it is a growing position, and it is a ever evolving position. But the basic concepts are those things that are set in stone, and that were set in stone well before I was an assembly member, because they were set in stone to me as a child growing up at 309 Lafayette Avenue or Mitchell Lama building that houses so many Black and Brown people, even to this day, who are looking for a better life for themselves and for their families.
Great. And the building that we're talking about, I should name, is at 960 Franklin Avenue. And you know, your critics would say that, or maybe not your critics, but people who disagree with this project, would say that, look, it's just not enough, right? Like, it doesn't provide enough affordable housing. And it sounds like, you know, correct me if I'm wrong in your response, it sounds like what you're saying is like, look, there will be some affordable housing, and also economically, this is about a bigger picture, right? This is about like, what is the bigger economic picture that it brings to the neighborhood, not just on housing access.
Right. And look, like I said, there's no other project that's doing 50-50.
When you say 50-50, you mean 50-50 market rate versus affordable housing.
And no one is coming close to that. And this is a project that is being touted by the trade unions. Other members want it in their district. I know that the borough president of the Bronx, Ruben Diaz Jr., is going to have a similar project in his district. Before the Sears parking lot was turned into a COVID testing site, they were also looking to do a very similar project there as well. And ultimately, I do believe a project like that will be done. But, you know, and I understand people who live in that area have a very...
And see all the buildings going up on all Bedford. The buildings,
and they see the Bedford Union Armory going up. And look, we were able to renegotiate the terms of those projects, even after we had a multitude of charrettes with the community getting what they wanted and understanding that a kid who grew up there, who had the bowling alley, who had the skating rink and had outlets. And we've gone to almost two generations where children in that area of Crown Heights had nowhere to go, you know, had no place to be, to be a child, to be a, you know, to be a teenager. So we're looking forward to all the benefits that project will be bringing. But ultimately we understand that we can't stick our head in the sands and say, I'm not going to deal with what's going on around in my district. I'm just going to deal with just trying to preserve what we have, because that's a defeated mentality. I'm going to continue to deal with preserving what we have. And that's why we passed the tenant protection unit. The TPU of 2019, and we're going to continue to advocate for other laws that will empower tenants all throughout the city and the state, whether it's good cause eviction or the like. But we're also going to be a part. We're not going to be shut out of conversations dealing with housing, whether it's for our LGBTQ seniors, dealing with housing or amenities for our LGBTQ youth. Whether it's dealing with building 100% affordable housing at 1024 Fulton Street, whether it's building affordable housing for a single mothers at the Bishop Walker site, which is affiliated with the site that's owned by Interfaith, that we as part of the Vital Brooklyn Initiative. So there are so many people in so many circumstances that need affordable housing, and we need to be a part of that conversation about how do we build it and how do we properly publicly fund it. Whether it's through unions or through the state or through a combination. So to me, I think that to just think that there's only one way of dealing with affordable housing by just only preserving it, I think is a little bit naive and a little bit narrow-minded, because when you step into the shoes of being an assembly member, you have to be an assembly member for your entire district and understanding the needs and desires of everybody who lives in your district and what they want to see going forward.
Well, whether you agree with the assembly member or not, you've heard his position. So make up your own mind. Thanks so much for that. As a single assembly member representing Central Brooklyn, how do you maintain objectivity in your position as an assembly member while also, right? Like, so you have this job, you're an assembly member, but then there's this business of running for office, right? And it's in the best interest of the assembly speaker, the leader, Carl Hasty, to get you reelected if you're going to agree with him, right? So how do you maintain objectivity in your job as an assembly right. member while being supported by the Democratic Assembly?
Well, there have been a number of times in which I've been at odds with the speaker, whether it's suing him as a party plaintiff for on behalf of WFP, suing him and the majority and the leader of the Senate as well as the governor, and getting an earful for that, because rarely do a sitting member in the assembly sues its own leader, right? Whether it's voting no on the budget.
Yeah, you wild for that. but we also need folks to be wild.
Whether it's voting no on the budget. And like you said, like we said before, a vast majority of members still just go along to get along. But voting no on the budget, you know, is really a position of saying no to the leadership's final conclusion as to where the budget ultimately, you know, stood and eventually was voted upon. So there have been a number of examples where I've been on opposing sides of the speaker that are glaring.
Great. Well, thank you so very much for just taking some time to talk broader Central Brooklyn constituency. Much love, folks. All right. So thanks so much for listening. And make sure you listen up for our next interview, which is going to be with Farrah Forrest, who's also running in the 57th Assembly District. So we're here today with Farrah Forrest, who's running for the 57th Assembly District seat. Hi, Farah.
Hi, Antonine. How are you?
I mean, you know, pandemic. How are you doing?
Pandemic too.
All right. Cool. So for voters who have never heard of you, who are you and why should they vote for you?
Okay, so my name is Farah Souffrant-Force. I am 31 years old. I was born and raised here in Brooklyn and in Crown Heights, and I actually still live in the same apartment I grew up in. I come from Haitian American parents. I am a nurse and tenant activist. I am really deeply committed to my community. I worked as an educator before I became a nurse, the Uber driver. Someone should vote for me because I really stand for the issues that most people who lived in the district are facing. I stand for universal rent control. I am fighting for universal health for everyone in New York State. And I'm fighting for a Green New Deal because climate change and a health crisis is what we're currently facing right now.
Thank you. So as we know, Central Brooklyn has been disproportionately affected by COVID-19. So what's your assessment of what is needed right now in this moment?
As a nurse, I need to tell everyone, first of all, make sure you're still washing your hands, socially distancing, and remaining healthy. We must make sure that healthcare workers are getting the resources that they need, especially personal protection such as gloves and masks. We must take every step to make sure that they're safe, that they can do their jobs, even if that means taking over uncooperative companies, right? No patient should have to pay a red cent for corona treatment because healthcare is a human right. So that's why I'm really fighting for the New York Health Act. This is also an economic crisis. As a socialist, I know our economy is built on austerity for the working people and a stimulus for the rich. People are laid off and the working class are still struggling more than ever to get back. We need a full suspension on all rent payments, period, because housing is a human right. And in the long term, we really need to reject economic stimulus for the rich. Now is the time to build a society that works for everyone. Now is the time to fully fund our hospital. Now is the time to make free healthcare a human right for all. And now is the time for universal rent control. I've put out a platform detailing more of what needs to be done. And definitely it comes from the people. This will likely be the greatest challenge of our society, greatest challenge our society has faced since the Great Depression. It will not be easy, but we can do it if we fight and we organize together.
Thank you. So we know that you support the New York Health Act, which supports creating a single-payer system in New York State. And your opponent, Walter Mosley, is also in favor of that. So tell us the difference between you all's support here on health.
As a nurse, I also am very proud of my colleagues and the work that we've been doing, especially during this crisis. And my experience working both in healthcare and with housing has just taught me that it isn't simply enough to just sign on to a bill and say that you're supportive of it. For us to really push forward the New York Health Act, we need all parties on board. And that means that we really need to amass a coalition behind the issue of a single-payer health system. Because there's a lot of pushback, you know, from different sectors, right? But it's not simply just enough to sign on. You need to be out there championing the cause, organizing coalitions, making sure that everybody is educated on the importance of a single payer insurance company. And that is the difference between me and Walter. I go out and I actually organize, I lobby. As a nurse, this is what I see is the difference between a healthy patient and an unhealthy patient, their ability to actually access quality healthcare. So I definitely think that there was a lot of strides, right? You know, it's great that you support the bill, but are you a fighter for the bill? That the next step in terms of how the New York Health Act is passed will be really depend on how strongly you advocate and you push for the bill, both in the district and in Albany.
Thank you. And another question is on housing. So Farrah, could you tell us a little bit about your housing vision for the district? And we know that you've also said that your opponent is absent on housing. So if you could also speak to what that even means for him to be absent on housing in terms of your vision for the district.
Yes, so I can talk definitely when last June, when the housing bills were finally passed, 8 out of the 9 bills were passed. That was a culmination of efforts across New York City and across the state. And I had joined the tenants movement about 3 years before. And when we went to Albany, we were planning to get arrested for housing. Now, what we weren't prepared for was the violence that ensued that day. That day, I remember standing outside the assembly hall and being kicked in the back, being pushed around. And there was only one state legislator that was standing with us, and it was not Mr. Mosley. Our politics, our issues are not a spectator sport. So it just doesn't make sense to stand by and just watch the very people who are from your district fighting for housing, which is a basic human right. And so my vision, right, for the community is to have affordable, truly affordable housing, housing that is designed to keep people in the district. We have seen rapid rates of gentrification occur within the last 8 years. And that's because we've had an incumbent that's not been active on the issues. So clearly the difference between me and my incumbent is that he signs on to a bill, I get arrested for housing, stronger housing rent laws. We need to pass finally the good cause eviction bill that would extend protections to market rate tenants. And then I, you know, inferred along, I really would like to see that housing is actually written into our state charter as a human right, right? So no more will we have housing that's for profit, but rather to house human beings in a humane way.
Awesome. Well, we definitely believe in being humane. So thank you for clarifying your housing position. And then finally, I actually wanted to ask a question in terms of a statement that you made once. Folks have heard from you saying that the DSA is not a party of gentrifiers, right? So could you, for our listeners here, just clarify, like, what is the DSA vision for Central Brooklyn, and how do you fit into that?
Yes, I do push back against that statement that DSA is a party of gentrifiers. From my experience, both as a member of DSA and being part of coalitions that, you know, DSA makes a part of, I have seen that, you know, DSA is really just an eclectic group of people, both diverse and of age and nationality. But the main thing that everyone agrees on is that the working people have been pushed against for too long, and that it is time for them to really step up and control the means of production in our society. So what does that mean is that there are some unequivocal human rights that we should have and that we should depend on to meet our basic needs. Housing, healthcare, economic, racial justice, that's what we fight for and that's what we stand for. The last part of the question, what was the last part of the question again?
Yeah, no problem. Just how do you fit into DSA's vision for Central Brooklyn? As a person who's not a gentrifier, right? As a person who's been in the same apartment your whole life, how do you fit into that?
So definitely, I think, especially through my campaign, it's just been very clear with the support of everyone in DSA and in the community that it is time that we had a working class woman, a Black woman, an immigrant, a woman of immigrant descent. I think that having DSA backing up me and other candidates of color just really solidifies the fact that what we're fighting for is basic human rights, and that when, as socialists, when we talk about the upliftment of our communities, we have to really focus on the upliftment of our most vulnerable communities, our Black and Brown communities, our peoples who are low economic status. So it just makes sense to have a candidate and support a candidate that fits all those criteria.
Great. Thank you so much. I mean, it's hard to not be excited when you talk about a Black woman, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So great. Yeah. Thank you so much, Farah. It was such a joy to talk to you and hear about your vision for Central Brooklyn and why you're running. And folks, if you're listening, this is Brooklyn Deep Third Rail, and we're going to be signing off with our second candidate for the 57th Assembly District, Farah Souffrant-Forest. Thank you so much, Farah.
Thank you so much, Andy.